What should we do financially to get through the pandemic? We're spending the hour on our finances and preparing for retirement in these times. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us. COVID, we know, is taking a massive toll on our economy. According to new polling from NPR and public health researchers, households with incomes below $100,000, they reported serious money problems. What's your financial situation like? How much do you save as we head into 2021? How are you looking at your family's budget and what to do amid furloughs, layoffs, and impending instability at work? How much of each paycheck can you stash away? We're at 800-642-1234. Emily Guy Birkin is a money coach and retirement expert. Her most recent book is called End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. Emily, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, prior to the pandemic, the vast majority of Americans already lived paycheck to paycheck. How do you go about getting that stability and having an emergency fund to be able to dip into?
It can be very difficult when you are living paycheck to paycheck, when you are, you know, always counting on the next paycheck to be able to keep up with your bills and things like that. So what I recommend is that people start very small. And so a lot of times you think, you know, starting small, like, you know, I can spare $20 from each paycheck, I can spare $5 from each paycheck, you know, a small amount isn't worthwhile. Because you're thinking that, you know, what is that $20 going to do if I have an emergency next week? The thing is, though, it adds up quickly. So starting with a small amount when you are living paycheck to paycheck and having that automatically transferred to a savings account is a really good way to first get in the habit of seeing a little bit of money move from your paycheck to that emergency fund savings account. And it also over time adds up. And once you have kind of gotten used to it, you might find, oh, you know what? I have that $20, I have that $50, whatever that small amount is. I could probably up that by 10%. And again, it's a little bit, but a little bit every paycheck is going to do a lot better than if you're waiting for an ability to, like, oh, I've got $500 I can put into an emergency fund all at once. That's unlikely to happen. So, you know, do make like you know, it's the ant and the grasshopper. Make like the ant and just put a little bit away at a time.
And it's interesting you say try to do it in an automatic setup, you know, and so you're not having to think about it and make sure you do it every month, that it can be on an automatic transfer. What do you like about that?
Well, a lot of people just don't like thinking about money. So that for a lot of us, it's a source of stress. And so one of the things that making it automatic means you only have to make that decision once, and then it's just simply taken out of your hands with every paycheck. So there's that aspect of it. You know, that it's less stress if you're looking at your paycheck going like, how am I going to be able to do this? If it's just automatic, it's already done. And you're working with that, the paycheck minus that emergency fund transfer. The other thing is, it means that you are allowing this to happen without having to, you know, make a special trip in your own head. So instead of having to treat yourself like a bill, which I do recommend if that's something that works for you with your money psychology. But it's if you're not the sort of person who likes thinking about, you know, paying yourself first as a bill, it just means that it happens outside of your consciousness. And then when you go, oh, goodness, I need money because the car broke or whatever, you can be like, oh yeah, I have that emergency fund that I wasn't thinking about, and let's go see what's in there. There's $700 in there. That's great. That'll take care of this.
Emily Guy Birkin is our guide. She's a money coach, retirement expert. We're discussing your money questions as they're complicated by the pandemic economic fallout. What is your financial formula? How much do you save? How much of each paycheck are you able to invest or stash away? Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Emily, what circumstances constitute an emergency, especially these days amid the pandemic?
That's a great question, because that commonly happens where if you are faced with an emergency, it might feel like not the right kind of emergency. This happened to me several years ago. My mother became very ill, and I was trying to figure out how to fly home to Baltimore, where I'm from, to see her when our emergency fund was nominally for if my husband were to lose his job. And so I was twisting myself in knots, going, like, how am I going to afford this last minute flight because I don't want to take from the emergency fund? When it finally occurred to me, how is this not an emergency? Mom's in the
Yeah.
hospital. So that's the sort of thing is don't assign too narrow a definition of emergency to your emergency fund. But you don't want too broad a definition. You might be like, oh, it's an emergency, I need new clothes, when your clothes are just fine, you want new clothes. So the thing to think about is with an emergency fund, that is to pay for something that absolutely must happen, that you do not have other ways of paying for without hurting your way of life, taking food off the table or something like that. It can be very difficult to determine exactly what an emergency is, and especially in the age of COVID, where we are in this extended state of emergency.
Right, there may be multiple emergencies down the road. That
Yes, it is very, very difficult to determine that, and this is a kind of an unprecedented thing for people in my industry. We usually have these recommendations, have 3 to 6 months worth of expenses set aside as an emergency fund, and so that's where it gets to be where you want to be triaging. When it comes to money issues, when there's this extended emergency, what is most important to make sure you have that roof over your head, you're getting food on the table. Those are the highest level. And then things like that debt pay down that you're working on, that can be put on the back burner. And so doing that kind of triage for your financial obligations can help you determine what is the emergency that you can use your emergency fund and what can wait and maybe continue to accrue interest until things stabilize for you.
Emily, our family's emergency fund is actually tied to a credit card type savings account. And every time, it's interesting, every time you log into the credit card to see, your balance and what's going on there, you also see the separate account, which is the savings account, the online savings account. What do you think of these offerings from credit cards that offer a savings account type, type offering?
They can be very, very helpful for the right person. Anyone who might struggle with credit card debt or who struggles to regularly pay off their credit cards, having something tied to a credit card can be an invitation to overspend. But for anyone who is able to use that simply as another method of payment that they're able to consistently pay off, this could be a really good option to kind of increase that emergency fund options.
Interest rate isn't too bad.
Yeah, exactly. So it's people know their own weaknesses, their own psychology. So if you are in a situation where you are, on top of your credit card payments, you're not tempted to spend, go right ahead. It can be a good way of protecting yourself.
Personal finance challenges, they are running deep and wide in this pandemic. And we have money coach Emily Guy Birkin helping us navigate all this. How do you save money? Do you have a savings account at your bank? Maybe a money market account? How risky is your investment portfolio? Are you aggressive in your market approach, or have you decided to liquidate assets, maybe to help get through these times? Share on investing your money questions, your money tips, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emily Guy Birkin right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing money matters here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Financial uncertainty is stressful, but there are some actions that we can take to make it less so. And we're looking for the things that are within our control. The question is, what are you afraid of financially? What can you do to minimize the risk and danger? what would you do if your worst case scenario did come true? Talk it through, 800-642-1234. We have money coach Emily Guy Birkin, who stays with us. She wrote the book called End Financial Stress Now. So Emily, let's talk about your jam, which is retirement. And so many Americans have considered dipping into their retirement savings to cover expenses due to what we're seeing right now in these times. What should we consider before dipping into retirement?
So one of the things that the government has done to help people during this crisis is the CARES Act has changed the requirements and penalties for if you want to dip into one of your tax advantage retirement funds, like your 401k or your IRA. So what that means is, under normal circumstances, if you take money from a tax advantage retirement account, you are going to owe a 10% penalty for taking it prior to age 59 and a half. And there is also going to be a 20% withholding of the amount that you take out, which is not a tax. That is simply the IRS keeping some of that money just to ensure that you will be able to pay your taxes, your income taxes on it, because it is considered regular income. So because of the CARES Act, there is now no longer a 10% penalty, and there's no longer a mandatory 20% withholding. What that means is that it is easier for people to take money out. That is not necessarily a good thing, for a couple of reasons. One, if the money is not invested, it's not growing. And so that's money that you have planned for the future to be able to retire on. And so you're going to lose out on the growth until you either pay it back or you continue to put money in over time once things stabilize. And so you're going to lose quite a bit. It's not just the dollar amount that you're losing. You're also losing compound interest over time, depending on how long it takes you to put that money back in. In addition, while you can, you are going to have to owe those taxes, the CARES Act allows you to pay taxes over 3 years. So you do not have to pay it all for the 2020 tax season.
What is the tax burden?
So that's going to be at your marginal tax rate.
Okay.
So whatever tax bracket you're in, you're going to be paying the marginal tax rate on the amount that you have taken out. So one possible benefit is if your income is much reduced in 2020, you can plan on paying taxes all in 2020, and then you will owe less than if things recover in 2021, 2022, because it is based on your marginal tax rate.
Oh, because if you do lose your job or if you're furloughed, your income drops a lot, then that would put you in a lower tax bracket.
Correct. Yes. But again, that still means finding you still are going to owe taxes on presumably a large chunk that you've taken out. And so you either have to set that chunk aside, set that amount aside to pay your taxes or be able to come up with it. So it's a bit of a devil's bargain because, yes, you are going to owe less because your income is lower, but because your income is lower, it may be harder to pay the amount that you owe.
Emily Guy Birkin is money coach and retirement expert. We're discussing difficult money situations and how to stay afloat in these times. You can join in. There's a line for you. Are you close to retirement and wondering if you have all of your financial situations in order, or are you far from retirement and wondering what you should begin doing with investing and saving? Have you considered dipping into your retirement savings to get through these times? Let's talk it through, 800-642-1234. Emily, a nuts and bolts question here. What is the process to get access to your retirement funds?
So you're going to have to go through your provider for your tax advantage retirement account. So through your 401k, through your IRA. It's also important to note that there are some requirements to be able to to access it. You have to have been affected by COVID and you have to be able to prove it. So affected by COVID means that you or your spouse has been diagnosed with it. You have either lost your job, been furloughed, or had otherwise had your income affected because of COVID. That includes because you have childcare, because you needed to take time off to take care of your child or children because of COVID. And you're going to need to be able to show proof that this is what happened. So that's the first caveat. The second is that not every provider of these kinds of retirement accounts is going to allow these. So it all depends. So I would recommend if you get this through work, talk to your HR department to find out what you need to do. If you have an IRA, you can call them directly and to find out what you would need to do to make this happen if you decide you want to.
And speaking of IRAs, there's also changes in the CARES Act to IRAs. There's no more required distribution at 70 and a half. Is that right?
It's actually, it has been moved up to 72.
72, okay.
Yes, yeah, it was 70 and a half for many, many years. And then I believe it was the Secure Act changed it to 72. And then for 2020, there are no required minimum distributions for 2020 because of what's going on with COVID. And so that is both for people who are retired and over the age of 72 and for anyone who has received an inherited IRA. So if you inherited an IRA from a parent or family member and you are, you know, much younger than 72, there are still required minimum distributions. So if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, you are each year required to take a minimum distribution from that inherited IRA. So that's another response to COVID, in part to allow you to keep money in the markets, in particular after the major downturn that we saw, you can give it a chance to bounce back.
Emily, I'm wondering, you know, if you were nearing retirement right before COVID struck, right before the pandemic, and you had looked at the end of 2020, say, as your retirement year, should you reconsider? What should you be thinking about if you're really close to retirement right now?
So there are a couple of things to be thinking about. One is, are you going to be able to extend your working time? This is a time where a lot of people are being involuntarily retired. So if you could extend your working time, if that's something your employer is going to allow you to do, that's something to consider, just to see if maybe things stabilize a little bit before you officially start your retirement. Another aspect to be thinking about is your asset allocation of your investments prior to retirement. So asset allocations means the specific things that you have invested in. Over time, stocks tend to be more volatile, so they react much more strongly to changes in the marketplace. But they also tend to have a greater reward over time. So if you invest for the long term in stocks, you're likely to see things trend up over time relatively quickly. Bonds, on the other hand, tend to be less volatile, but their returns are lower. And so one of the things that is very commonly counseled for retirement is that you shift your asset allocations to go from more stocks to more bonds as you get closer to retirement. And then I take that a step further. As you're nearing retirement, you're going to want at least your first year to 3 years worth of living expenses in something that is very stable, like cash equivalents. So those are things like CDs, T-bills, money market accounts, things that are going to be earning you some interest, but you know will be there in case the market just simply takes a powder. And so that's something, if you have not thought ahead about that, and you are planning on retiring in late 2020, you might want to hold off on your retirement plans if you're able to, so that you can safely shift or invest into those more short-term, stable but not quite as rewarding investments.
And it sounds like they're pretty liquid. They're pretty accessible.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the another aspect of why I recommend this is you are not going to have to depend on selling things to be able to reach that money. You can just take it out right away and use it for your living expenses.
Retirement and money coach Emily Guy Birkin is our guide. Are you nearing retirement? What are you thinking about your retirement funds and how you get by? Are you looking for a job and you landed an interview? How do you suggest negotiating a salary or an hourly wage in these times? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick it up on Pocketbook Issues with Emily Guy Birkin right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing money stress this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have our eye on a bipartisan group of House lawmakers who put forth a plan this week to address the coronavirus relief stalemate in Congress. One of the biggest sticking points has been Congress's expired unemployment program that had offered that extra $600 a week to people who lost jobs in the pandemic. After this aid went away, what did your family do? How are you getting by financially? What questions do you have about retirement, about bill paying and debt? It's 800-642-1234. Emily Guy Birkin is a money coach and retirement expert. She stays with us. Let's bring in a question now from Barb in Milwaukee. Hi, Barb. What's your financial situation?
Good morning. I am retired for about six years and have recently gone back into the workforce. And my question is how is that affecting my retirement? Do I have to do anything other than worry about taxes?
Barb, thanks. Emily, what about that situation of someone retiring and then going back years later?
That's a great question. And the main thing that might affect, there are two aspects that might affect. First is Social Security. If Barb is under her normal retirement age, which is generally about anywhere between 65 and 67, if she's under her normal retirement age, getting outside income through work could affect her Social Security benefits. That's called the earnings test. And so I believe for 2020, the earnings test is somewhere around $18,500. I don't know the exact amount, but up to that point, you can keep every single dollar that you earn from income, from work income. After that point, $1 of every two that you earn. So if it's 18,500, if you earn 18,502, one of those dollars is going to affect your Social Security. So that means your Social Security benefits will be reduced by that $1. However, once you have reached your normal retirement age, and with Barb having been retired for 6 years, the likelihood is pretty good that she is past her normal retirement age, then that is going to not going to affect her Social Security, and she can just continue to work not worry about how that's going to affect anything. The other caveat is if she is over the age of 72, and again in 2020 it doesn't matter, but if over the age of 72 and having to take required minimum distributions, it may be easy to forget about those required minimum distributions if you're earning other income. But you are required to take those minimum distributions as of 2021, because if you don't, the IRS is going to levy a penalty against you for not having taken it. So depending on your age, Barb, you either want to double check on how much you're earning versus the earnings test with Social Security, or double check to make sure that you are continuing to take your required minimum distributions. And the next one is not going to be due until December 31st, 2021. And so those are the only two kind of guardrails you need to worry about.
Barb, does that make sense?
Absolutely. My one final question about that, though, is let's say I make $1,000, okay, a year, and what percentage would I have to take out for a minimum distribution? Or for retirement?
So the required minimum distribution, it depends on two factors. It depends on how much you have invested, so the total amount you have invested, and your age. So the calculation is going to be different for every single person. You're going to use the IRS life expectancy table and your age, and that gives you a formula for determining what your RMD is. And so, unfortunately, this is something that each taxpayer is required to do. The buck stops with you in determining the correct required minimum distribution. And that's one of the reasons why I highly recommend that people who are retired partner with a tax professional, because this is the sort of thing you want another set of eyes on, just in case. Although the IRS does, if you make an honest mistake, that's different from, willfully doing it wrong.
Barb, thank you for the call. We're talking with Emily Guy-Birkin, who is a money coach and retirement expert. We're spending the hour on your pocketbook questions, your saving and investing, preparing for retirement questions in these difficult times. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Peter now in Green Bay. Hi, Peter. What's your situation?
Retire at age 61. What would you recommend doing for health insurance between that point and the point that I could go on Medicare?
Hey, Peter, we lost you at the very first part of your question. Can you say that again?
If I were to consider retiring at age 61, if I were to retire at age 61, what would I do for health insurance? What would you recommend I do for health insurance up until the age I become eligible for Medicare?
Peter, thanks. Emily, what would you suggest?
So that's a great question, and one of the toughest aspects of navigating retirement if you retire before age 65, which is when you're eligible for Medicare. There are only a couple of options for you. The first is to check with your employer to see if they offer any method for continuing with the health insurance after retirement. That is sometimes part of a retirement package for some employers. That is not necessarily going to be the case for all employers, in which case, if you were older than 61, if you were 63 and a half, for instance, you may choose to use COBRA, which allows you to continue paying for the group health insurance that you got through work. Unfortunately, the reason why I say 63 and a half is that it only continues for 18 months. That is the length of time you're allowed to use COBRA. Finally, going on the health insurance exchange through the Affordable Care Act is often going to be the only option available. And that's something that thankfully is available now, was not always. Many people, including an old neighbor of mine, decided to just kind of grit their teeth and try to make it to age 65 without going to the doctor, which is really not a sustainable plan. So going on that the marketplace to find health insurance is something that I would recommend doing before you get to the point where you're talking to your employer about retirement. You know, looking what the options are, how much it will cost for you to purchase individual insurance through the marketplace, so you can plan for that as a line item expense for at least those first 4 years of retirement before you are eligible for Medicare.
Well, health insurance can be so expensive. COBRA can be very expensive. Medical debt is a huge issue in our country. How would you suggest we navigate the debt from medical bills?
Medical debt is a real problem. There are a couple of things that people are not necessarily aware of. One is that you can negotiate with medical creditors. You can negotiate with the hospital. You can negotiate with if it goes to a creditor. You can call and negotiate and work out payment plans, a reduction in the amount that you owe, and those sorts of things. What's infuriating is that often we're putting this on people who are already sick and should be focusing on feeling better. There are patient advocates out there who will do this on your behalf, which again, if you don't have a whole lot of money, that can be a problem. But because you do need to pay for these patient advocates, but that is something that you can do that will end up costing less than paying some of these enormous, overwhelming bills, $80,000, $100,000 for getting sick. So those are things that I would highly recommend that people do. Remember that the numbers that you receive on this medical debt does not necessarily reflect the amount that you are ultimately going to pay. And so trying to work with the hospital, with the creditor, can make a big difference in how much you're going to have to pay. The other thing that I would recommend always is calling your representatives and talking to them about what's going on with your medical debt, with how overwhelming it is, because that is how change happens and how we can get to a point where we're no longer dealing with these, five, six figure debts because of illness.
I had an issue with some dental billing at one point. And I also went to my HR, human resources, and they placed a call to the insurance company and said, because they had another number that they could dial into, and they explained the situation. And they were also able to get me a resolution more quickly. Might that be a path?
Absolutely, yes. If you have a human resources department, or sometimes even if you call and talk to the doctor's office, they may have a phone number that they can call and get a quicker resolution. There are a number of different paths, which is again infuriating. The consumer should be able to reach someone who can do something for you, but if you are hitting your head against the wall for yourself, you can look around to see who you have access to, who may be able to help. And so your a human resources department, if there's a legal department at your work, or your doctor.
Financial coach Emily Guy-Birkin is our guide to money and budgeting in these times. Do you stock up on supplies in these months? Are you eating out of your cupboard? Or do you have tips on how to save at the grocery store? Maybe you're paying down your credit card debt balances more than ever now. What is driving your financial decisions? And what fears do you have about money? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emily Guy-Birkin here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with money coach Emily Guy-Birkin. We're discussing financial stresses as a new NPR survey reports nearly half the households in America are reporting facing serious financial pain. And it's more acute in large cities and among Latino and Black households. What is your money question? It's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jim now, who's joining us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the program. It's been very informative. My question is, my wife passed away some years ago. She was not on Social Security, and I am on Social Security. Would the absence of her potential draw on my Social Security affect my present Social Security payment?
Jim, thank you, and so sorry about your loss, Emily.
Jim, that's a great question, and I also very sorry for your loss. So the way that Social Security works when it comes to spouses is it all depends on who was the higher earner. So the fact that your wife did not draw on your Social Security does not affect your benefits. What would affect your benefits is if she had earned more than you and would be receiving a higher benefit than you, in which case you would be entitled to a benefit that is equal to what she earned. So for instance, if your benefit is, let's say, $1,500 and she would have earned $2,400, then your benefit as a widower would be $2,400 because it would be, your benefit, plus the difference between your benefit and her benefit. So that extra $900 to be the $2,400. The fact that she passed away prior to, receiving benefits based on your work history does not affect your benefit amount.
Jim, does that make sense?
And yes, it does. And thank you. It cleared up the issue. I've been trying to ask Social Security that, but they never seem to answer the phone. So,
Jim, thank you for that question. Emily, you know, talking with Jim there, is it difficult right now amid these times with COVID-19, so much remote work going on? Can you get through to Social Security and other departments to get answers to these types of questions?
I know it can be difficult. One of the problems is if you're trying to call your local Social Security office to get a question answered, that's not actually the job of the agents who work at your local Social Security office to you know, answer these questions. It's their job to get you set up with your benefits. So they can't necessarily answer these questions, even if they're not overrun with phone calls and are regularly answering the phones or making it easy to make an appointment to talk to them. It's their job to implement the benefits, not necessarily answer questions about them. That's one of the reasons why I actually recommend the Social Security website, ssa.gov. It is very well put together, very user-friendly, and in general, like the search function and the frequently asked questions and all of that are pretty easy to navigate to help you find an answer to those questions.
Is that your first step for if you want to start drawing Social Security?
Yes, I definitely would recommend starting on SSA.gov. And then also they have a program called My Social Security, where you can sign up and you can see specifics about how much you can expect. And this is true for people who are retired and people who are years from retirement. Every single individual with a Social Security number can get a My Social Security account. And that will let you know, based on your work history, what you can expect both from retirement benefits at your normal retirement age, retiring early, and if you wait until age 70, and also from disability benefits if you were to become disabled. You get a sense of how much, based on your current work record, you can expect from each of those benefits.
Emily, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Emily Guy Birkin is a money coach and retirement expert. Her most recent book is called End Financial Stress Now. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about discovering a place in the universe at Rib Mountain.
Author Jill Sisson Quinn like spending time at Rib Mountain State Park outside Wausau. She recently took a hike there with her young son for a lesson about our place in the universe.
I want my 4-year-old son to climb a mountain. Not so easy in Wisconsin. Long ago, mountains as high as the Rockies covered the area, which is now our state. But today, I'll have to settle for 1,942-foot Rib Mountain. It's a remnant of that ancient rocky-sized range buried by sediment, then revealed through erosion. I'm not concerned by the modest elevation because this mountain sports something more impressive, its age. Rib Mountain contains some of the oldest rock in the world. At 1.7 billion years old, these rocks have been around for more than a third of the Earth's existence. We rub our hands across the striations on the side of a boulder, made by waves when the now quartzite was a river valley or ocean bottom. Long ago, this rock used to be sand, I say. I am awed by this evidence of the rock's previous forms, first sand, then sandstone, now quartzite. I tell my son to think about the ripples the ocean makes along the seashore. He gets it, looking around the heavily wooded mountaintop and responding, "There must not have been any trees here then." Next, I tell him the rock's age, knowing full well his understanding of such things still has a long way to go, his own number of fingers and toes as yet a daily discovery. This window of not yet complete awareness of his own form might be a good time, I figure, to convince him of what we, like the rock, really are. "The rock is old," I say to my son, "but you and the rock are really the same age, around 13.8 billion years old. The atoms in your body and the atoms in the rock made just after the birth of the universe and in exploding stars. You are stardust." "Stardust," he repeats and smiles. He's heard me say it before. I want my son to take the long view, to think like a mountain even when he is not on the mountain, and not only about the earth, as Aldo Leopold imparted, but about himself. We should not get mired in how one strand of identity formulates us, but consider all the strands, the food we eat, the microbes we host, where we grow up, and the DNA we inherit, no more or less important than the atoms that make up all this stuff. I don't deny what we appreciate in the rock, its consistency of form, being itself, over such an unimaginable period of time. It's old, it's something, it has exactly the sort of permanence we ourselves desire. I come to the mountain today not only in a parent's feeble attempt to make my son seem immortal, but to help him better navigate life's journey, its hard facts, as well as its uncertainties. 100 years, the most humans can expect, is not much. Yet over that 100 years, our solid-seeming body is in constant change. Individual cells live from a few days to at most 10 years, continuously rebuilt from materials from our immediate environment. We are not sandstone, then quartzite for a billion years, or even human for 100. We are sea, land, and sky, all in one lifetime.
Jill Sisson Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
And we bring you Wisconsin Life, our window into the wonders of our state and people. It comes our way on Wednesday and Friday mornings here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.